Good day to you. Before we start the show, I just wanted to talk for a minute about our partnership for the month of January with FEE, the Foundation for Economic Education. There are too many young people graduating from high school without any education in economics. In fact, there are too many young people graduating from master's programs in economics without any education in economics. So I'm fully behind FEE's efforts here. I'm going to put a graphic in the Facebook group and in the show notes for this episode on the website. Share this with a young person. FEE is going to be hosting three-day seminars across the United States in the very near future with the primary goal of teaching young people the power of economic thinking. Anyone between the ages of 14 and 26 can apply, and they'll have the opportunity to learn the economic principles that affect career prospects, investment decisions, and business strategies. And if you're between 14 and 26, you're going to find this a great opportunity to learn new methods of thinking that can help you pursue your passions in a way that serves yourself and possibly others as well. So join top students, successful business leaders, and great teachers to discover the relationship between personal and social wealth, as well as the virtues of an enterprising life. The total tuition cost for the 3 days is only $79. That includes all meals and housing. I don't understand how that's possible. $79 is like 120 minutes at Columbia University. Tuition and travel reimbursement scholarships are also available. There's no charge to apply. Applications are reviewed and accepted on a rolling basis. Apply today at fee.org/students. And please let them know in your application that you heard about this opportunity through the School Sucks podcast. Thanks.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hey, everybody. Hope you're having a nice weekend. How are you enjoying 4.0? Maybe it's too early to ask. You've only heard two episodes of this new thing. See, from my perspective, this project is much further along because so many upcoming shows and conversations have already been all planned out and some have even been recorded. I'm like a baker who just can't wait to pull more cookies out of the oven and put them in front of you. But everybody's mouths outside the kitchen are already so filled with cookies. But here, take some milk and wash it down because this new batch is even more delicious. Cookies. That's how I feel about this month. I hope this feeling lasts all year. I hope you're enjoying it. I appreciate all of the feedback and suggestions and questions that have appeared in the group so far. And if you want to start a new thread, I encourage you to use the hashtag SSP Productivity Month. I can just click that tag and I can see every single conversation that we've had this month. In fact, it was yesterday morning. I asked the group for questions for Jake DeSillis. He and I recorded yesterday. Our primary topic was something called Horizons of Focus. If you don't know what that is yet, you will before another week of your life goes by. You know, there was a question that came up in the comments there. A listener named Wilson writes in and he says, "Honestly, I often have trouble with even current action, much less having a purpose, which is a higher altitude in the horizons of focus. I believe this is largely because I have nearly always been shot down when I announce any kind of forward plan. I understand that this is largely excuse making, but this is based on very real experiences. I'm just not sure how to get past that." I totally understand that. You know, I've had to talk to an MSNBC viewer or two about what I do for a living, and it is frustrating for me and confusing for them. And then often their confusion turns to a state of infuriation and rage and yelling and ad hominem attacks. Now, I want to answer Wilson's question in a couple of ways. First of all, we're going to deal very specifically in today's show, which is largely about goal setting tips, who you should share your goals with and who you shouldn't share your goals with. I misspoke a minute ago and I said I had to talk about what I do. with a type of person that I describe as MSNBC viewer. I didn't have to talk about anything with them. In fact, today, when I encounter that personality type, you might have some rough idea what I'm talking about. And they say, what do you do? I don't even engage. In fact, what I've got into is I carry around a pocket full of balloons that have the face of Bernie Sanders on them. So when you blow them up, it looks like a giant floating Bernie Sanders head. And I just lead this person into a fairly drafty area, blow up the balloon and let it go. And they'll usually chase it. I'm sorry, that's not a true story. And that was kind of mean. The point I'm trying to make, I guess, in a very roundabout way, is by the end of today's show, you'll have some new ways of thinking about sharing your goals. Now, in the upcoming show with Jake, where we talk about horizons of focus, I think that going through this process has the potential to create a kind of momentum for our goals and ambitions that can't be stopped in its tracks by the general shittiness of other people. So, Wilson, stay tuned. Not just this show, but also the next show. We'll have hopefully some answers. Another listener named Philip writes in and says, thanks to Brett and Nathan for this important show, talking about the first part of the conversation. I have had many issues with setting goals, not meeting them, and then hating myself for it. I also have a lot of problems with prioritizing and figuring out what's most important to me at the moment. I think it's time for me to go back and listen to the Six Pillars. That's the Six Pillars of Self-Esteem series that Wes Bertrand and I did at the beginning of 2014, actually throughout most of 2014. He mentions another series here that we did at the beginning of 2015 called Stop Procrastinating Now, parenthetically, or soon. And of course, the productivity series that we did in the summer of 2013, it was me, Richard Grove, Tony Myers, and ultimately Jake DeSillis. Those are the voices in that series. It was called Presence and Productivity. And I do want to stop for a second and just say presence and productivity is what we are revisiting and updating and expanding in this SSP Productivity Month. So I really recommend that you hear those six shows before getting too much deeper into what we're doing this month, because we are going to go into new territory. And Jake and I will explain a lot of that in the next show. So anyway, Philip talks about going back and revisiting these three series, the Six Pillars, Stop Procrastinating Now, Presence and Productivity, to help. He says, so far this year, I've done a good job of not letting negative emotions take over me and ruin my productivity and having more compassion for myself. So again, same message to Philip. I'm hoping today's show will provide some valuable insights, but please stay tuned. The next show with Jake DeSillis is a really, really, really important expansion on what Nathan and I talk about in today's show. And just a final note before we start, because this actually relates to the conversation that Nathan and I already had. We talked in the last show about David Allen's self-management matrix, where the two axes were perspective and control. So the Presence and Productivity series that we did in 2013 was largely based on Allen's methodology, getting things done. I was trying to use GTD as the solution to a fairly disorganized and fairly chaotic life, seemingly so for me at the time. And in that series, my focus was really on getting control, the clearing off of the runway. And in this phase, in this update of that series, we're going to be talking more about perspective. So that was previewed in the last show. It's expanded upon a little bit in this show. And we really, really get into it in the show that follows on Horizons of Focus. So I hope that provides some clarity. Thank you so much for listening. Here we go. I'm a more whole, whole world on hold. Your crown is like whole, operators like whole. Please hold. Man, now ain't that cold. I'm just trying to talk to my homie that's up in the hole. And home girl not trying to be a hoe. Even though she on the pole, can she get a second chance? No. Whoa, like the opposite of gold. That ain't how it's supposed to be. A butterfly. But for the sake of rhyming, let's just say butterfly yee. The truth stings like Muhammad Ali. I tell him, don't homicide me. I'm just a little old hope with his back against the ropes. Fighting for his fans and fighting for his folks. But the booze from the crowd can become so loud. If I can block him out, then I can knock him out and dance around the ring. But until then, I'll say, I'ma keep it cool and I'ma do me. It is what it is and it's how it's gonna be. Until
till I get there. Till I get there.
The new year is here. This is often a time people want to try out some new goals. They usually fail, right? Anytime I needed like fitness equipment or musical instruments, Craigslist, February. Great place to find, you know, a Bowflex or a drum set. That's usually when they're for sale.
Yeah. So I'll start off by saying I released this episode that we're going to be talking about right now. Mm-hmm. I released it at this point in time because that's when it's most applicable to the majority of people out there. But for me, all the stuff that I go through in this episode are not ways that I start the year. These are ways that I do things continuously throughout the year.
Let's talk about the first one, the difference between dreams and goals. I have dreams.
I have dreams as well.
So what is the difference?
The biggest difference between a dream and a goal is most of us have dreams. Most of us have these lofty ambitions. The difference between a dream and a goal is that a goal is more solidified. A dream is kind of like a wish, or we fancy this particular thing happening for us. A goal is when we really solidify it by creating a plan for it and creating a deadline for it. So a dream and a goal, the biggest difference between the two is a goal is just a dream with a plan and a deadline.
Yeah. Or in the terms that we've discussed so far, a dream with GTD applied to it becomes a goal.
Yeah. And the thing about it is a dream can make you feel good. This is something that I've noticed in myself and in other people. A lot of times just thinking about the outcome that we would like to have, just thinking about how great it would be if this particular thing happened, that can kind of trigger the endorphins, that can trigger the good, warm, fuzzy feelings inside of us. And just dreaming about something can give us kind of a substitute for actually accomplishing things. So a lot of times, because setting a goal is uncomfortable, it requires a lot of work, and because a dream can kind of substitute for that and still give you that warm, fuzzy feeling that accomplishing a goal can give you, a lot of times people are totally content with going through their life only ever dreaming because they get almost the same pleasurable response that they get from setting and accomplishing goals without actually having to go through the hard work of setting and accomplishing goals.
That's interesting. That makes me think, you know, like I've done a lot of that in my life, dreaming or even fantasizing, you know, just even thinking back to like, well, what did I want to do when I was like 10 years old? I wanted to be on the radio, you know, like talking to people. It all had to do with sports back then, but like in command of explaining a baseball game to people who were listening or watching on TV. I went to a camp for it. I couldn't wait to learn more. It was why I went to college and majored in communications. It was a dream. I don't really know where it came from. I'm sure there was some deeper rooted need, maybe just for attention at the center of that. But having those dreams or those fantasies can create a kind of gravity, I guess, that it compels us to take action.
Sometimes.
Sometimes
people stop at just the dream and they're perfectly content just having the dream. I know lots of people who have brilliant ideas, have awesome stories trapped inside of them, have awesome creations trapped inside of them, and they're content just talking about them. And maybe it's the fear of failure. Maybe it's the fear of actually putting the hard work in. Who knows? But I know so many people that have really brilliant dreams. And I think that the fact that just dreaming can kind of give you that substitute for accomplishment, I think that that can be a very self-destructive thing. So yeah, when you have a dream and you apply a goal or you apply a deadline and a plan to it, that's what makes it a goal.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've had plenty of experience with that. I remember I was like 17 or 18 and I got caught at a stoplight air drumming the shit out of Tom Sawyer. I think I shot the person a look like, hey, yeah, I bet you wish you were in this car, as they laughed at me. But I felt bad about it. I was like, well, I'm going to learn to play the drums. And I never did. But it was a dream, you know, to be on stage pounding away like that. But
and it felt good in your car in the moment.
Oh, it felt amazing. It felt amazing. I had many air concerts in my car as a young man, but never really turned that into musical talent at all. I mean, it did pull me. I think by the time I was like 25, I had managed to like fiddle around on the guitar enough to convince somebody that had no knowledge of guitar playing that I could play. So there was just a light gravity in that direction from the musical fantasies. But I take your point. I think this is really important, that some dreams will make us feel good enough that we actually want to move in that direction. And then having something that is clarified as a goal adds like new stakes come into it at that point, because then we can fail if it's not just a dream anymore.
And it's not nearly as comfortable as just dreaming.
Absolutely. That's the perfect transition to the next one. Our goals should be outside of our comfort zone, right?
Mm-hmm. And you talked about this earlier. It's not really something that should be considered a goal if it's something that's really easy to do. So if it's for me, like I've got to record another episode of Anarchopreneur tonight, that's not a very good goal because I'm comfortable doing Anarchopreneur. And when your goals are constantly within your comfort zone, they start to become habit, they start to become mundane, and they start to be a lot less rewarding, and you put a lot less into them. Goals should cause you to grow. They should cause you to expand. And that's why goals should be outside of your comfort zone.
Yeah. And I mean, I think they could be related. You could use activities with which you are already comfortable to push a little bit. So the example for me in December, and we talked about this somewhat extensively privately, was the Cantwell show, right? That was really, really nerve-wracking, quite honestly, for me to go into his studio knowing that I was going to disagree with him, knowing that he had this reputation for being somewhat hostile. You know, I walk in and I sit down, I sit down at his desk. I don't know him that well. I mean, we've had a couple of pleasant interactions in the past, knowing that our conversation could be fairly contentious. There's a handgun on the desk. There's an AK-47 on the wall behind him. I'm not saying that that scared me. I'm just saying that I was aware of those things being there. And when I remember pulling into his driveway and saying, this is either going to be a great success or a catastrophic failure. This is a live show, right? With somebody who is very, very, very comfortable. And I like Chris as a person, and I really, really appreciated the conversation that we had. But that's on the other side of it. That's the comfortable feeling after moving through that discomfort. You know, and I have to admit, I was uncomfortable going in there. I was scared. Not that anything bad was going to happen to me, like physically, obviously, but that I was going to fail at what I set out to do, and I was going to do it most in the most public way possible. That's a live show; people are listening to it live. So that I felt was, for me anyway, a big risk, and there was you know, something safe and really satisfying on the other side of it.
Yeah, and I'll kind of relate this back to me coming on this show. You've always been somebody that I've looked up to. You've always been somebody that you've kind of been one of those guys that I'm like, oh, well, Brett's able to do this. I should be able to do this as well. Being a fellow podcaster and seeing your success coming on to this show, I've had a little bit of bubbles or butterflies in my stomach saying to myself, what if Brett's audience thinks that I'm a total loser? What if Brett's audience says, I found no value in that conversation whatsoever? I know that coming on here might lead some of your listeners come back and listen to my show, but it might also do the opposite and be like, did you hear that schmuck Nathan Frazier? Oh my God, what an egotistical jerk. But the payoff for it is I might get some new listeners and we might have a great conversation, and some of your listeners might get a lot of value out of this conversation. So it definitely was not inside of my comfort zone to come on to this show, but it's something that I'm hoping will be valuable for myself, for you, and for your listeners.
Absolutely. Is there a little bit of an easier feeling now that you realize that I'm not nailing all these in one take?
No, because I messed up a couple times throughout this conversation. I've said the wrong word, or I've messed up and stuttered in a sentence, and I'm like, oh, that's going to be my failure. Even if the show is successful, people are going to look back at that one time I stuttered.
But in the future, the people listening to this might not even get to hear those little mess ups that you made, or me completely losing my train of thought for 5 minutes because of the magic of editing.
That's true. I didn't take that into account.
Yeah, that would be a way to podcast outside of my comfort zone. Just go to YouTube and click stream live every time I'm going to start recording. But yeah, I mean, I think the point I was trying to make with the Cantwell story, and it relates to what you were saying as well, is that there's ways to using skills we already have or areas and pursuits where we already are comfortable to push a little bit further, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then some goals need to be completely outside of our comfort zone. I've talked just a little bit in the group and in the show about the creation of online courses, which is one of the goals for 2016. Entirely outside of my comfort zone. Even though it's like it's me talking and recording it, it's me teaching. Those are two things that I have experience with, but this for some reason seems like completely different.
Well, I relate this back to an image that I have in my head of a dot inside of a circle and a dot outside of a circle. And the dot inside of the circle is you. The parameter of the circle is your comfort zone. And the dot outside of the circle is where all of the magic happens. Everything that's worth achieving in life is going to be outside of your comfort zone. Every goal that's worth pursuing in life is going to be outside of your comfort zone. If you stick to goals only inside of your comfort zone, you stay trapped your entire life inside of that parameter. And every time that you reach outside of that parameter grows. And each sequential time, it grows again from the last time. And so the people that are most successful are the people that are constantly reaching beyond the comfort zone.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, I actually had something related to that that I just wanted to inject into the show right here. It might take me about 5 minutes to read the whole thing. Is that okay with you? It's called The Science of Your Comfort Zone and Why It's So Hard to Leave It.
If it's going to be beneficial to the conversation, feel free.
Absolutely. Simply, your comfort zone is a behavioral space where your activities and behaviors fit a routine and pattern that minimizes stress and risk. It provides a state of mental security. You benefit in obvious ways: regular happiness, low anxiety, and reduced stress. The idea of the comfort zone goes back to a classic experiment in psychology. Back in 1908, psychologists Robert M. Yerkes and John D. Dodson explained that a state of relative comfort created a steady level of performance. In order to maximize performance, however, we need a state of relative anxiety, a space where our stress levels are slightly higher than normal. This space is called optimal anxiety, and it's just outside your comfort zone. Too much anxiety, and we're too stressed to be productive, and our performance drops off sharply. The idea of optimal anxiety isn't anything new. Anyone who's ever pushed themselves to get to the next level or accomplish something knows that when you really challenge yourself, you can turn up amazing results. More than a few studies support this point. However, pushing too hard can actually cause a negative result and reinforce the idea that challenging yourself is a bad idea. It's our natural tendency to return to an anxiety-neutral, comfortable state. You can understand why it's so hard to kick your brain out of your comfort zone. Even so, your comfort zone is neither a good or a bad thing. It's a natural state that most people trend towards. Leaving it means increased risk and anxiety, which can have positive and negative results, which we'll go into in a moment. But don't demonize your comfort zone as something holding you back. We all need that headspace where we're least anxious and stressed so we can process the benefits we get when we leave it.
That is powerful.
The next heading: what you get when you break free and try new things. Optimal anxiety is that place where your mental productivity and performance reach their peak. Still, increased performance and enhanced productivity will just sound like do more stuff. What do you really get when you're willing to step outside of your comfort zone? First, you'll be more productive. Comfort kills productivity because without the sense of unease that comes from having deadlines and expectations, we tend to phone it in and do the minimum required to get by. We'll lose the drive and ambition to do more and to learn new things. We'll also fall into the work trap, where we feign busy, oh gosh, as a way to stay in our comfort zones and avoid doing new things. So true. Pushing your personal boundaries can help you hit your stride sooner, get more done, and find smarter ways to work. The next one: you'll have an easier time dealing with new and unexpected changes. In this article at the New York Times, Brené Brown, a research professor at the University of Houston, explains one of the worst things we can do is pretend fear and uncertainty don't exist. By taking risks in a controlled fashion and challenging yourself to do things you normally wouldn't do, you can experience some of that uncertainty in a controlled, manageable environment. Learning to live outside your comfort zone, when you choose, can prep you for life changes that force you out of it. 3, you'll find it easier to push your boundaries in the future. Once you start stepping out of your comfort zone, it gets easier over time. This same New York Times article, which is linked here, explains that as you step out of your comfort zone, you'll become accustomed to that state of optimal anxiety. Productive discomfort, as they call it, becomes more normal to you, and you'll be willing to push further before your performance falls off. 4, you'll find it easier to brainstorm and harness your creativity. This is a soft benefit, but it's fairly common knowledge, and it's easily reproducible, that seeking new experiences, learning new skills, and opening the door to new ideas inspire us and educate us in a way that little else does. Trying new things can make us reflect on our old ideas where they clash with our new knowledge and inspire us to learn more and challenge confirmation bias, our tendency to only seek out information we already agree with. Even in the short term, a positively uncomfortable experience can help us brainstorm, see old problems in a new light, and tackle the challenges we face with new energy.
You know, I feel like all of that is very insightful. One of the things that I was realizing while you were reading that, stepping outside of your comfort zone at first, it's very difficult. But after a while, it almost becomes addictive. And being kind of like autodidactic, one of the points that you mentioned in there is the reward that you get from stepping outside of your comfort zone and learning new things and experiencing new things. It does become, at least for me, it starts to become one of those things that little else is exciting. For me, taking on new challenges, learning new things, creating new things are a huge driving point of my life. And I don't know if that's just naturally how I am or if it's just kind of what evolved because of constantly stepping outside of my comfort zone. But at first, when you step outside of your comfort zone, when you reach for goals outside of your comfort zone, it's a lot more daunting than once you've done it a bunch of times, it starts becoming exhilarating and exciting. And I don't want to make it painted in a negative light, but it almost becomes addictive to start reaching further than what you're comfortable with.
So your comfort zone has very low walls, it sounds like. In the past, especially when for so long in my career, I did pretty much the exact same thing every day, either as a teacher or as a tutor, I just felt so uninspired, you know, like with the SAT courses, doing the same thing, saying the same thing over and over and over again, driving to the next place. And I felt as a result of working that way, you know, my comfort zone was more like, you know, the Star Wars trash compactor kind of thing. It wasn't just something that I could wander out of, you know, from time to time. But it sounds like you've developed that ability.
Yeah. And like I said, I still get hung up sometimes. I still have that fear of failure. I still have that discomfort associated. I mean, obviously, if it's outside of your comfort zone, you're still going to have discomfort about it. But it does become easier and easier, and it becomes more and more exhilarating. And I don't know, I still deal with the same things that I dealt with before. It's just, it doesn't have the impact and it doesn't have the setback that it used to have. And after a while, reaching outside of your comfort zone not only becomes easier, but it becomes something that has an intrinsic benefit to it as well.
Absolutely. The third one, make sure to not overwhelm yourself with goals and then just give up. What do you mean by overwhelm? Too many? Too big? What kind of overwhelm are we talking about?
I wouldn't say that there's a such thing as too big, but definitely too many. This is one of the things that I fall victim to still, and I struggle with, is setting too many goals or trying to accomplish too much at one time. Everything that you say yes to, you have to defend that yes with 1,000 no's. And knowing which ones are really worth saying yes to, a lot of times I say yes too frequently. Yep. And I say yes to too many things. And then I have to go back and break my commitments. And that never feels good. So setting too many goals or setting goals that conflict with each other, this is probably something that you deal with. Double booking yourself or you know, it's Thursday night and you have to get this done and you also have to get this done and you've only got time to choose between one of the two. Spacing out your goals, if you're going to take on a lot more, don't have all of them due at the end of the week. Have, like you mentioned earlier, monthly goals and weekly goals and yearly goals. But taking on too many goals at one time and taking on goals that are not that will work against each other. So being very, very clear about which goals you actually say yes to. And that's probably the biggest one that I struggle with, but it's also probably one of the most important, to be clear on what you're going to say yes to and how it's going to affect your prior obligations and your future ones. Because if you say yes to this, it definitely means you're going to have to say no to something else.
Yeah, I get what you're saying there. And I'm thinking about the four goals for School Sucks that I wrote in 2016. And I was careful about how to write them. Because, you know, I understand the same thing as with something little, like setting up a morning routine. When you really start to take something seriously, making sure that you don't overwhelm yourself. I mean, that's the failure of the New Year's resolution, right? Everything is going to change on January 1st. And when nothing changes, or when things change too slowly, or when the change is too big, everything just collapses. So I wrote my four goals carefully, even though they're all big goals that are going to require, you know, the awareness of several milestones and sub-goals. They all relate to each other. They're all intertwined. One is bigger than the one that comes before it, but achieving the one before it makes the bigger goal much more likely to achieve. So taking that advice, I was very careful in how I formulated goals for 2016. And yeah, I think like setting three or five at a time, having all of them basically working on different timescales is really important as well.
And another thing to kind of take it down to the micro, you mentioned something called a morning routine. I am a huge proponent of having a morning routine. But a lot of times when we first start thinking about doing a morning routine, I use something called the Miracle Morning. And I try to, each morning, I try to go through something that's called the Savers routine, which is I have five different things that I try to do. I try to have a little bit of silence in the morning to kind of collect my thoughts. Mm. I'm not very good at meditating. It's advised to meditate. I am not a very good meditator, but I enjoy having a little bit of silence in the morning. Then I go through my affirmations. I go through my vision for the future. I go through a little bit of exercise every morning. Then I sit down and I do some reading, and then I do some writing. And I try to accomplish all of these every morning. Well, when I first started doing my savers, I set a 2-hour period in the beginning of the morning. And I was like, I'm going to do this many push-ups, this many squats, this much stretching. I'm going to sit and meditate for this amount of time. I'm going to meditate until I actually can meditate. I'm going to read this much. You know, I'm going to spend half hour reading, half hour writing. Mm-hmm. And I quickly became discouraged because it was just way too much. So I scaled it back. I said, I'm going to write in my 5-minute journal. I'm going to make sure I read at least 15 pages. I'm going to set up a way to have a formulaic way to go over my visions and my affirmations. And I scaled it down so where instead of just taking on this lofty thing, going from 0 to 100 made me want to hit the brakes. But going from 0 to 30 and then working from 30 to 60 and then working from 60 to 90, I found much more effective. So when you're first starting to set goals, setting a bunch of goals or setting goals that will just overwhelm you is not, it's not very effective. But setting goals that are outside of your comfort zone but are still achievable is a much better way to go about it.
Yeah. And related to what you were just describing too with a morning routine, I think I'm going to do a show on this, but building a morning routine starts with saying, I'm going to do this in the morning. And then maybe it works out that way for a couple weeks. And I said to myself, okay, I'm going to do this and this in the morning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if that was successful, I would say, okay, then I'm going to do this, this, and this in the morning. But also taking an inventory of what I already do in the morning and asking myself, is it helpful or is it basically a distraction or a waste of time? Why am I doing it? What can it be replaced with? But if the answer is that it is helpful, that becomes part of the morning routine. It becomes part of the checklist. Make coffee is on my morning routine, right? Because it gets me to my desk where I start sipping my coffee and writing in my journal, right? So it's there for a reason. It's an important part of my day. It's an item that I can check off, and just to, like you were saying, as a kind of momentum builder, right? Once that's done, okay, what's the next thing that needs to be done? So it is a way of starting slowly, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going from 0 to 30 rather than 0 to 100.
Right. How do you feel about deadlines? Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, I find that it obviously helps with prioritization. Intermediate deadlines help me start a project slowly, which is something that I've always promoted on the show when talking about productivity. Being able to play around with something in the beginning is always nice. Having a kind of creative freedom space instead of just like saying, all right, here's the thing that's got to be done today, now, that kind of thing. But let's talk about deadlines for a minute while we're here.
Are you familiar with Parkinson's Law?
No.
So Parkinson's Law is that energy, resource, time will expand to what you allow it. So if you say, I have to have the garage cleaned by the end of the weekend, you'll probably clean it Sunday afternoon or Sunday night.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you set the goal on Friday, it will take all weekend to get the garage cleaned.
Right.
If you set the goal on Friday, I have to have the garage cleaned by tonight, then your garage is going to be cleaned Friday night. So setting deadlines is very effective. Setting deadlines will help you reach your goals a lot faster. I sometimes run into the problem of setting unrealistic deadlines where I say this needs to be done at this particular time. Podcast Blastoff, it was my company that I launched in 2015. We launched it in October. Our deadline was for hopefully around July, August. We didn't meet the deadline, but if I hadn't set a deadline at all, we probably still wouldn't have it launched. So setting deadlines is good. I like to have that wiggle room in the beginning where I'm kind of like filling the idea out. But as soon as I have a solid idea of what the goal is, or at least what the sub goals are, deadlines are very, very effective. And if you don't set a deadline, you'll... Typically, it's just like, I have this goal to clean my garage. It can take all month unless I say it has to be done by the end of the weekend. Then it'll be done by Sunday evening. Unless I say it has to be done by Friday night, then I'll have my weekend to do whatever I want. So yes, I do believe in setting deadlines. And I think that once you understand how Parkinson's Law works, setting deadlines becomes incredibly effective in reaching your goals.
Yeah, it also relates to next actions, right? Like next actions can even have deadlines, and context is important for next actions as well. I've played around in the past with using tags in Evernote. So I'll have a tag called at home or at errands or at desk, or which is at studio basically. And if I click on that tag, I can see all the things that need to be done in that place, which is also helpful for planning work. But yeah, I get what you're saying. Like, clean the garage is the name of a project, right? But if clean the garage was 20 steps on a checklist and each step had, you know, a time frame, that I think, for me anyway, is a lower stress way of working than doing a project called clean garage at 6 p.m. on Sunday night with the deadline by the end of the weekend, right? So with other types of projects, using next actions and having a time frame for each action based on a context, are there other people involved? Are those people available? How much time will this thing take? And my example with the tags was, am I in the right setting to do this thing, is also useful.
Mm-hmm. So you might have something that's tagged out and about, or you might have something that's tagged at my computer, or you might have something that's tagged at home or at the office. And that way, the context of where you're at also is involved in whether or not that action step is accomplishable.
Absolutely. And that actually goes back. I'm reminding myself, because sometimes, you know, there's so many moving parts in Evernote in getting things done. And this is going to be a show this month too. That sometimes we stray away from certain things, and I really need to get back to using those tags. It was actually Richard Grove that introduced me to that idea when I was actually staying with him and working with him back in 2013. That's when a lot of the GTD stuff was getting up and running for all of us and started getting incorporated into this show. But location tags can be very, very useful. That's a reminder. The next one relates specificity. A lot of times people make goals and they're kind of vague, huh?
Well, probably the most typical goal is I want to lose weight, but that doesn't really say anything. Like, you can cut off one of your limbs and you've accomplished that goal. So that's losing weight is not a very big or a very effective goal. And it's very vague. And specificity says, I want to lose this much body fat by this time. It's again, going back to setting a deadline with it and really getting clear. One of the ones that I like to use is a lot of us in the truth movement or the libertarian movement, we say we want to change the world. Changing the world is very non-specific. It doesn't give you a clear map of where you want to go. So if you say instead, I want to change the world by going out and doing positive impacting activities in my community, that's a little bit more specific. And that gives you a little bit more towards what you're going to work for. And then if you say, I want to go out and I want to do jury nullification activism, or I want to go out and I want to feed the homeless, or I want to go out and I want to talk to people about this and start up a meetup about this, like Liberty on the Rocks does, where they have meetups where people get together and they discuss these ideas. Those are very much more specific and very more likely to actually be accomplished. When we just say, I want to change the world, that is a giant goal that has no real guidelines or borders around it. And it has no real definition and is very unlikely to ever come into fruition.
Yeah, absolutely. And the measurability, right? Like quantification is really important. And the more you specify, the more you're able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember my webmaster, who's a friend and a great advisor, Tony, really pushed me out of my comfort zone with this one. He said, so what's one of your goals for School Sucks? This was a while ago. This was over a year ago. I said, well, I want to make more money. And he said, yeah, of course you do. And he's like, so how much money do you want to make? And I'm like, wow, I don't know. Because then you start asking these questions like what's realistic, what's acceptable, you know, all of these types of questions. And so I just said a number. And he's like, why that number? And I was like, well, shit, I don't know. What's wrong with that number? He's like, it's kind of low, you know. So to move into something that's specific, but also not too modest, right? Because the more information you get, the more you might realize that, oh, I'm setting the bar too low, or the opposite, I'm setting myself up to fail at something. Even though failure is totally okay, the more information you have, I think the better chance you have at actually being successful.
Well, and it's kind of like geographically, let's say I'm here and my goal is to be somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know which way I need to walk. I don't know how fast I need to walk. I don't know whether I should start walking now or I need to start walking next week. If the goal is somewhere else, that's not going to help you at all. If the goal is I'm here and I want to be 5,000 miles to the east, now you know I need to start walking east and I need to start walking today. And if you say the goal is I'm here and I want to be 5,000 miles to the east in a week, then you know I need to start walking versus I need to start riding a bike versus I need to buy a car. So just saying I'm here and I want to be somewhere else is very vague and unaccomplishable. By specifying I want to be this particular place and I want to be this particular place by this particular time, then you have a much more likely chance of creating a plan that will help you accomplish it.
Absolutely. And your next tip is one of the most important and also relates to that, writing goals down.
Yeah, I think that I hate to get woo-woo and I don't believe like The Secret. I don't know if you're familiar with The Secret.
Oh, yeah.
But the whole idea of writing it down and bringing it into fruition, I'm not on that tip, but I do believe that there is power in writing things down. And the first step of writing it down does make it real, even if it's just mentally. It makes it more grounded in reality for you. And writing it down in a place where you'll see it. Behind me, I have two whiteboards. I have one on my wall and one on my door. And the one that's on my door has all of my overall goals, my overall affirmations, and then underneath it, the reasons why I have those goals. And when I wake up in the morning, the first thing that I see when I get out of bed is I see the actual handwritten down goals that I have, and writing them down and having them in an area where they can be reviewed is incredibly valuable.
Absolutely. I did read a study, I think it was done at Yale University, written down goals, 42% more likely to be achieved, according to that study.
I believe it.
Yeah. So, and hopefully my desktop background will work towards that end this year. How about the next one, reviewing them? Do you have like a process or a specific app that you use for tracking, whether it's, you know, every day, every week, every month? How does that work for you?
Well, I do it every day. I have most of my overall goals written on a whiteboard right behind me. And the ones that I've accomplished, I check them off or I erase them and replace new goals on there. I review mine almost every single day, probably every single day. The larger ones I am constantly reviewing in my head. I have kind of open loops on some of them that are constantly going through my head. But having them written down in an area where I can review them every day, you kind of mentioned earlier the problem of having them in an Evernote where you can collapse it and you just see goals and it doesn't get reviewed that way. That's why I have them written down and on the back of my door so that every morning when I wake up, before I even open my door to leave my room, I have to review my goals. I think that that's, for me at least, that's one way to constantly drum them in my head, to constantly keep them at the forefront and not allow them to slip into the dark caverns of collapsible Evernote notes.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. A whiteboard is a great idea. There was one time in the history of the show where the office where I recorded didn't really work for sound, but all of the walls, thanks to the webmaster I had at the time, Ofer, all of the walls were dry erase boards. They covered 80% of the wall. So I could just get up, grab a marker, go to the wall and write. But I didn't have a method then. So now I'm adding this to the Amazon wish list, giant dry erase board. Maybe there's some kind of dry erase paint.
There is. You can actually paint your walls with it. And that for a graffiti lover like me, I'm afraid I would probably abuse that.
That is awesome to know. All right. That's a post-it right there. Definitely need a new whiteboard now that I have a better method for using it. I used to use it to draw mind maps of shows, which was useful, but I think that actually having goals and the steps to achieve those goals written in a way that I could see it every day would be really, really helpful.
And I'm going to add this. This was not on my original list, but having the reasons why you want to accomplish those goals is huge. For me, I want to be able to spend more time with the people that I love. For me, I want to be location independent. I don't want to have to be stuck working a 9-to-5 job and stuck in a location in order to be able to earn my income. So for me, I have very specific reasons. It's not just I want to be rich or it's not just I want to be famous. For me, it's I want to feel more fulfilled and I want to have more freedom in my life. And if you're working towards goals, but you don't know why you're working towards those goals, they start to lose the power. They start to lose the aspiration. And so writing down your goals, but also writing down why you want to reach those goals is very important.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is obviously part, it's like vision versus mission, right? In a way.
Yes.
The next one I think at this point have covered pretty fully, but we'll see if we want to add anything to it. Breaking goals down into action steps, right? We have long-term goals or even a long-term vision, but clear steps on how to get there.
It's just like we mentioned earlier, Stephen Covey in The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People and working with the end in mind. If you've got a goal and you don't actually sit down and plot a path, the chances of you reaching it are very unlikely. But if you do know this is where I want to go, and these are the steps that I need to take to get there. Having clarity, especially on that next immediate step, having clarity on the next immediate step that you need to take makes it a lot easier to actually get started on that path.
Now, there's another payoff here as well, right? And this relates to the momentum that's built through checking off items on a checklist, right? We can, as you said, I think in the show, celebrate each step along the way. It's not the goal is not achieved or achieved. You can actually witness the process of the goal being achieved by having next actions clarified, right? And that also creates an opportunity for gratitude and awareness of getting things done.
Yes, because at the 50% mark, you can either say, I still haven't accomplished this goal, or you can say, I've accomplished all of these action steps on my way to accomplishing this eventual overall goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes just one or two of those steps towards the achievement of a larger goal can be very satisfying on its own. Mm-hmm. The next two on your list are related. And I think we're just going to be previewing these today because we're going to talk about this in more detail later in the month. But finding mentors and accountability partners, that's important.
Yeah, I think we have right now, we're actually very fortunate because there are so many people out there. It used to be that in order to find a mentor or in order to find somebody who's already gone down the path that you wanted to go down was not very easy. To find somebody to apprentice under or to find somebody who could kind of shed light on the path that you're trying to walk down yourself was not very accessible. But now with the advent of the internet and with so many people that are content marketing out there, YouTube videos, podcasts, online courses, there's so much more accessibility to mentors that we're not really stuck where we used to be, where, you know, one guy could take on an apprentice, but he could only do so much for so many people.
Yeah.
Nowadays, the mentor process is scalable beyond belief. So we're kind of fortunate that we have that. And accountability partners as well. This is something that I don't think as many people take advantage of. And it's kind of like, you know, how do I find an accountability partner? Do I really want to be held accountable? Because most of us don't even hold ourselves accountable to things. It's not the easiest thing to have somebody else. It requires a level of vulnerability that a lot of people are not comfortable with. But having somebody to learn from, having somebody to mentor from, and having somebody to hold you accountable towards meeting those goals is incredibly beneficial. And we see this in like weight loss. A lot of times people will say, hey, I've tried this multiple times in the past. I haven't been able to do it. Let's me and you both commit to going to the gym. And that way, when you wake up in the morning and you're like, I don't really feel like going to the gym, and the other person is like, yo, are you coming to the gym with me today? You have that accountability partner, and you're not just letting yourself down. You're letting them down if you refuse to go. So that is very beneficial, having somebody that's going to hold you accountable, and it kind of makes you hold yourself more accountable.
And it also relates to having, you know, the right people to share goals with. Our goals can certainly take up a lot of our attention and focus and positive mental energy. And we want to talk about them. But sometimes, I learned this the hard way, not everybody is a good target for stories about the big goals that we have in life.
Yeah, and that goes into number 9, which is sharing your goals selectively.
Yeah.
There's two different sides of the coin where you can get yourself into trouble with who you choose to share your goals with. Number 1, you can share your goals with people that just kind of feed into the daydreaming, and it goes back to the original one where we were talking about, you get that substitute for actually accomplishing it by just dreaming about it. And some people, when you share your goals with them, they'll just help you dream. They'll be like, yeah, that would be awesome if that happened. And you get that release, you get that endorphins release where you get the good feeling of accomplishing something without actually accomplishing it. Then there's people on the flip side where they diminish your goals, and they can do it for 2 different reasons. Number 1, you share your goal with somebody and they're just a negative person and they don't have faith in themselves. They don't have faith in you, and you share your goal with them and they shoot you down. They're just that's part of their nature or part of how they've trained themselves to be, where you say, I've got this goal, and they say, that's stupid. And then there's other people that do it for this, do the same thing, but for a different reason, because they care about you. And they're afraid that if you embark on this lofty, ambitious goal, that you might fail, that you might get hurt. And they say, that's great, but I'm really worried. And I really think you should give this some more thought. And I would discourage you. And it's not because they're negative or they don't want you to succeed. It's because they care about you and they don't want to see you get hurt. They don't want to see you fail. So those three types of people that will just encourage the daydreaming, people that will shoot you down because they're negative, and people that will shoot you down because they are misguided in their caring for you. Those are three types of people that you should definitely not share your goals with. But if you have people in your circle that are people that lift you up, people that will help you, people that will encourage you, people that will be effective accountability partners for you, those people are definitely people that you should share your goals with.
Absolutely. There's probably even a little bit of crossover between the person who shoots you down and the person who claims to care, right? With the shooting down maybe being on a more subconscious level. It is a part of reality that some people, even if they claim to care about others, do not want to see them achieve levels of success that they feel they can't achieve themselves.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I think that one side of the spectrum would be, I'm just not going to share my goals at all for personal reasons. I don't want to put it out there. I don't want to have people be able to laugh at me if I don't accomplish it. I don't want to be shot down. So I'm just going to work on this quietly until it comes to fruition. That might be one way to take it. I really do think it is important to share your goals with people. I think that when you put it out there, you create another level of accountability. You create another level of actualization and probability being applied to that goal. So I think it is important to share your goals, but I think that it's very important to be very selective about who you share your goals with.
Absolutely. I think we'll revisit those two tips in greater detail probably later in this month with a couple other participants. How you feel about that?
I think that would be a great idea. We've kind of teased out a couple of times in this episode deliberately. I mentioned our mastermind, and I think that for me, having the mastermind has been one of the greatest things for accomplishing my goals. I've always been very goal-orientated, and I've always been successful at a good number of my goals, but the benefits of having a mastermind, having the accountability partners within it, are just take it to a whole nother level. And I know that me and you have kind of tossed around the idea of expanding on the idea of a mastermind. And I think that that would be incredibly valuable for your listeners.
And your show functions in this way as well. I mean, it's a little trickier when you have more than, say, a handful of people, but you're building a community around that kind of support and accountability.
Yeah, absolutely. I have found the mastermind process to be incredibly useful for accomplishing my own goals. And I'm trying to kind of scale that out for my audience. It's one of my own personal goals going into 2016 is to take the positive effect or the positive benefits that I've gotten from our mastermind group and scale that out to improve the lives of my audience. And that's definitely one of the things that I am putting the dominoes in line right now. And I'm slowly knocking down the first couple in hopefully the realization of having something that can do what our personal mastermind has done for me and take that to the entire broader audience of Anarchopreneur.
Excellent. Item number 10. What do you do, Nathan, when you fail? What happens?
So, and like I said, I do fail at some of my goals, actually at a bunch of my goals. I guess you got to take that personal inventory and say, why did I fail at this goal? Is there a lesson here that I can learn? And is this goal that's something that's actually worth pursuing? Because sometimes when you fail at a goal, it's because it just wasn't in the cards. Sometimes you can fail because the people involved were just not the right people. Sometimes you can fail because it just wasn't the right time. Very often, though, if you fail, it's just because there's a lesson there for you. And if it's something that's actually worth committing to, commit to it. And don't let failure be the nail in the coffin. Let it be something that you learn from. A mistake only becomes a failure if you let it stop you. So analyze it, get back up, and if it's a worthwhile goal, then get back on the road to achieving it. That's one of the things that really shoots most people down is they hit that first speed bump and they decide to turn the car off. It's not the way to handle it.
Well, I think my goals fail basically as dreams because they never become goals. They never get formulated into projects and plans. They don't make it that far. So to actually take something that say, oh, that would be really great to do that, and to turn it into a goal and a plan that leads up to that goal, that's something that I haven't done enough. I've had, wow, so many ideas. Like I talked about abandoned projects. But when I say that a project is abandoned, it could have been as simple as an Evernote creating a notebook called project colon blank, and then no notes ever get added to that project. There was an idea, right, to say, oh, this would be really great to do this someday. Sometimes they get dragged into this other folder called someday maybe, which might be getting a little crowded at this point. I get afraid to look in there sometimes. But a lot of goals don't make it to the goal state. They just stay as dreams. And even if I turn it into a project, that project has no definition and it has no starting point as a result of that. And obviously, without a starting point, without a plan, there's no way of achieving it. So getting over that fear of failure, clarifying more goals, creating plans and next actions, and trying more of these things is really important to me as far as a new pursuit in 2016.
Yeah, and it kind of goes back to knowing what you should say yes to and what you should say no to. And if you do fail or if you get a bad start on something, always go back and analyze it and say, is this really something that I am committed to? And realizing that if it is worth committing to, then you just got to get back on the bike. You got to dust your pants off, deal with the fact that you got a scraped knee and get back on the bike, because otherwise you're never going to learn how to ride the bike.
Absolutely. So Nathan Frazier, thank you so much for being the first School Sucks guest of 2016. This was a great way to start the year.
Thank you for having me. I am incredibly honored, and it's still a little bit surreal for me. I don't want to say I've built you up in my head as like this great man of Liberty Podcasting, but I kind of have. And to actually be a guest on your show, it's just been a dream. It's been a long-term goal of mine, and I finally reached it. So thank you.
How about that? Well, I really appreciate you saying that, Nathan, and I think this is going to be the first, even though what we did today is ultimately, I'm realizing as I look at the counter, it's going to become two shows, but there's going to be more shows in the near future where we talk more about collaboration and accountability partners for goals. In the meantime, how can people learn more about what you're doing?
So my main central hub is my website, livefreefm.com. And that's where I have Live Free FM, which is one of my podcasts. I have Freedom Media there. And the main focus right now is Anarchopreneur, which is a liberty-minded, entrepreneurial-type podcast. I kind of share my entrepreneurial journey with my new project, Podcast Blast Off. I share some of the things that I've gotten out of the mastermind group. I share marketing ideas, and I try to tie them back to how these ideas can be used to succeed in business, but also how they can be used to succeed in promoting liberty and our each of our own individual activism. So that's kind of my main passion project right now is Anarchopreneur. And you can find all of the episodes of that, along with pretty much everything else that I do as far as trying to promote liberty, over at livefreefm.com.
Yeah, you had a great line in a recent show where you talk about this pursuit of promoting the ideas of liberty, or even what might be summed up as truth movements. We talk a lot about other people's plans, and we don't spend enough time talking about our own plans towards those goals, right? Truth and freedom. And we need to be doing more of that. So I appreciate you turning up the volume on that issue.
Absolutely. And I appreciate everything that you do as well. Like I said, School Sucks Project is one of the podcasts I started listening to years and years ago, and I've never stopped listening to. I've never outgrown your podcast, and yours is probably the only podcast that I can say that's true for.
Thank you so much. That's great to hear. And we're going to keep growing in 2016. And I certainly appreciate your help, both as a guest and behind the scenes of that process as well. So thanks again, Nathan.
Thank you.
Bang. We did it.
Awesome.
New subscriber geography trivia. You just say a person's name and they tell a fact about where they live.
I want to move there. Today's new subscriber is Chris H., and Chris is from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Have you guys heard about this place?
Oh, Steve, please go ahead and cue up Aaliyah by Donny Iris, the best song ever to come out of Pittsburgh.
Awesome. I want to move there. Just from doing some basic looking into Pittsburgh for this edition of New Subscriber Geography Trivia, I'm thinking this might be the greatest city in the country. First of all, it's beautiful. It comes together at the confluence of two rivers, one the Allegheny, the other one I forget the name of, and I think they flow into the Ohio River. Beautiful cityscape, beautiful skyline, lots of exquisite yellow bridges. They painted all their bridges yellow. But there's so much more. I mean, I think the easiest thing to do when it comes to Pittsburgh is Pittsburghese, this special dialect of the English language that has developed there. That's very attractive for me because I'm often looking for excuses to talk in what I think is a silly voice. Now, that's subjective. I mean, maybe people in Pittsburgh think this Northeastern accent, even though I would say this is the absence of an accent. I call it the Ivy League English that we speak up here, news anchor English. Maybe that sounds very funny to them, but Pittsburghese sounds funny to me, and I wish that I could speak it on a regular basis. Sometimes in social interactions, I confuse new people because I will suddenly break into like a Chicago accent. I will say sausages or something just in the middle of speaking exactly like I normally speak. So I'd like to get into situations where I could do that more, and I think moving to Pittsburgh might be the answer. Now, I don't want to like make fun of Pittsburghese. I really like it. In addition to the accent itself, there are some unique vocabulary words like yins in place of you guys in the South, how they use y'all. But one of the most important attributes of Pittsburghese is what's called the monophthong. We have something in English called a diphthong. And what that is when two distinct vowel sounds come together to essentially make a new sound. Like in the word house, we have a O sound and a U vowel sound, and together it becomes house. There are no diphthongs in Pittsburghese. We get the monophthong, and that ow changes to ah, has. So if you were to ask somebody, where are they going? And they were going to say, I'm going down to the house. In Pittsburghese, it might be something more like dana has. That strikes me as being very efficient. We save oxygen, we save syllables. It sounds fun. I want to learn more. And we have another sound throughout most of the country where we put our tongue between our teeth and blow to get a th sound, th. It does not exist in Pittsburghese. So up here in New Hampshire, on the campus of Dartmouth University, people walk around saying, I know that, not in Pittsburgh. There it would be, I know that. Doesn't that just flow better? But th can also come at the end of words, like in the expression, both of you. So up here, I would say something like, hey, are both of you headed downtown? Maybe if I wanted to catch a ride with a couple of folks I know. But in Pittsburgh, if I encountered that same situation, I would say, hey, Butchin's gone downtown and that. And there's a syllabic efficiency that I really like. Like up here, we go, watch out. But down there, it's just, ciao. There's more examples. Up here, we say, I doubt it. Down there, it's just that it. Or if somebody says, hey, Brett, would you like some bologna? I would say, that would be great. But down there, it's just that'd be great. Steve, cue up Aaliyah again. Sweet. But let's leave Pittsburghese behind, and I'd like to tell you what I think is the absolute best thing about the city of Pittsburgh. And this is especially true for people like me who live in crowded areas. The Pittsburgh parking chair. From Wikipedia, it has its own Wikipedia page. A parking chair is a chair used by a vehicle owner to informally mark a parking space as reserved for oneself. Other objects are also used for this purpose, including trash cans, ladders, ironing boards, and other similar size objects that are commonly found in households.
For curbside parking spaces, two or more items are normally used. For angle spaces, only one is needed. In Pittsburgh, the use of parking chairs is considered to be an iconic regional practice. Now, of course, asshole legislators in one city after another across the country have outlawed parking chairs, but not Pittsburgh. Oh, my laundry, Pittsburgh. I know that.
New subscriber geography trivia.